Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This piece has been brought to you by Bonnie Plants, bonnieplants.com.
I'm Laura Stanley, host of Inside School Food. You are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irway. It's a great day here in Brooklyn, starting to look a little bit more like spring. We have Memorial Day ahead of us in a week or so, so I'm looking forward to picnicking in the park. But to discuss a trending topic of the last week, it was actually a couple weeks ago that this happened. Maybe you heard about it around the media world. But Eater, the you know, very popular restaurant and other food writing website, there was a little bit of a scandal when it was unearthed that one of its food critics, Nick Solares, had been previously, several years ago, a member of a band that was sort of this punk rock, white supremacist leaning, like skinhead sort of thing. And, you know, that was a big uproar. He apologized and said that's not who he is anymore, but you know, he caught up in the wrong, you know, folks, groups in the past, and all seemed to be forgiven for a while there. But then Eddie Huang opened his big mouth and wrote an op-ed in Grub Street where he not only, you know, expressed sort of appall at the idea of a food writer having possible, you know, bigot or biased leanings. He really brought up how much responsibility should Eater bear in the hiring of Mr. Solares. And I think that's a really interesting question. You know, what is due diligence when it comes to hiring anyone with any kind of checkered past, really? And nowadays that, you know, we have so much social media out there. We have so many clippings of ourselves. I would imagine it's not too difficult to dig a little, but, you know, what do you do when that happens? I don't know. Like, David, we just recently hired you at Heritage Radio. Did we, I don't know how much we looked into your past. Are you, were you in a skinhead band? Are you a bigot?
Oh my God.
I mean,
no, absolutely.
How does this
not
work?
No, I don't have any skeletons like that. I can proudly say, but,
I mean, do you think it's a good idea going forward to, you know, if we're trying to promote diversity and for publications that are, or any kind of media organization that does not want to be associated with racism, should we? Should everyone?
Yeah, I mean, like, of course, any organization should be doing its homework. And, you know, with the internet now, it's made it possible to really dig and go far back on somebody. Yeah, I definitely think that's something that is the responsibility of any responsible employer. I mean, it's just, and the way you phrased it, how he apologized, he's not that way anymore. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, but that means you're saying you were like that, and that's just not okay.
I mean, but if you're young, I don't know, maybe somebody had a sexual harassment issue when they were young, and maybe they made, I don't know. It could be all kinds of things.
Yeah, I mean, every situation and is unique. Like, it's all individual circumstances for sure. But yeah, that is kind of disturbing.
I think it is disturbing too because I don't know. I think that bias does leak into food writing and all kinds of journalism. So who knows?
Yeah, absolutely.
What the consequences are. So I don't know. Maybe we'll see more sort of dialogue or trying to figure out ways to screen people in the future
with
all the information that we can access. Okay, so going on to our wonderful, wonderful guest today. Maybe she has some thoughts on this too, which she can certainly chime in. we've got on the line Diana Abu-Jabbar, who is an acclaimed novelist. Her latest book is a memoir. It's called Life Without a Recipe. And Diana, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Kathy. I'm happy to be here.
How are you? And what do you think? What do you take from that little snippet? Do you think that
wow,
we should be suspicious? Or
that's fascinating. That's a really tough one.
Mm-hmm.
Because how much of the past are we responsible for?
Yeah.
What's the difference between youthful indiscretion and a really problematic kind of track record, shall we say, definitely I do think, when you look at the way we examine politicians, we want there to be full accountability. So,
yeah
that, I could see that following somebody into a career in journalism, because that too is a role of great responsibility to their public. So, yeah,
and maybe,
I could see it.
Maybe people will be just all the more aware that every action they do when they're young and being crazy and, who knows, making mistakes will be recorded. So,
that's one thing I will say. I'm very grateful I grew up before there was social media. So, yeah. Oh, man.
Well, you actually, in your memoir, you control the dialogue of your past here. So,
yes.
No, but you went there and you relived, I guess, much of your life through this book, Life Without a Recipe. And I love that it's, we start out with you're growing up in a household where you're really caught between two worlds in the kitchen. So your dad is Jordanian and your grandmother and he... Your grandmother on your maternal side, that is, really spar in this like war in the kitchen to win win favor for you through food.
That's right. It was a ongoing family war.
Your grandmother seems to have this opinion that people who don't make cookies or cook the way or think the way she thinks about cooking is somewhat less than there's some quote in there that where she's kind of stewing about this. I think that she takes a lot of pride in her cooking, which is delightful, but do you think that she took to your father's cooking as a lower form than her?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, she did. She, she was a baker.
Mm-hmm.
And so I came to discover when I grew up that cooks and bakers are really two very different kinds of personalities. And, Dad was this sort of dashing, improvisational, immigrant. So he had this sort of very fast and loose personality, but he was also from a place that my grandmother saw as very exotic and even kind of menacing. And so it operated on a lot of levels. It was personal, it was cultural, it was gender. My grandmother was just fed up with men. She was done. And, so right there, she was ripe for war with my father.
They were not off to a good start.
Yeah.
Diana, if you don't mind, I would love to read two short little passages that really illuminate those two personalities from your
great
book. Okay. So we'll start with Grace, your grandmother. Grace understood herself better when she baked. She settled into herself and heard her inner voice more clearly. Baking can become a bigger conversation in which the mind rambles far and wide. You consider not only the amount of sugar, but the way it glitters, the smell of its dust as you level it with a cup. Grace spoke of the elegant process of following a recipe, step by step, to some satisfying conclusion. Of course, that wasn't my style. I couldn't leave a recipe in peace, but had to be continually worrying it and playing with it. And then, I'm going to read a little passage about your dad cooking.
Sure.
During the week, my father works two or more jobs, but Saturday breakfast is a profusion, the sizzling morsels of lamb on the fava beans, diced tomatoes, celery, and onion on the hummus, tidy, half-fried eggs bundled around their yolks. We hurry to sit, then spend half the meal begging Bud, come to the table, sit down, sit. Always, he wants to slice one more cucumber. Definitely not following a recipe there.
Yeah.
So your book, Life Without a Recipe, I think that's just a really great starting off point for talking about the meaning of this book, because I mean, which style of cooking would you say even now you tend to favor, the more freewheeling, improvisational style, or the kind of strict baking mentality?
That's such a good question.
Because you grew up with both, yeah.
Yeah, it's a tough question because it's got a lot of layers to it. I think when I was younger, I loved baking, and I was really devoted to it, and in large part because I loved the end result of baking.
Mm-hmm.
So that was something that I used to bake regularly, on a weekly basis, if not a daily basis. And after my daughter was born, that was a huge part of our daily ritual, was, you know, all kinds of baking and showing her how to measure ingredients and following that kind of scientific formula. But as I got older and I was diagnosed with high blood pressure, I learned that I really needed to stop doing that. And I gradually have switched over to more of an improvisational cooking approach. And so I have found my father, you know, now in my 40s and 50s now, I have come over to my father's side of things because it turns out it's healthier for me. You know, it turns out that it's a better approach to eating. So it's been really kind of a fascinating journey for me. And yeah, I've completely swapped sides, I guess you'd say.
Do you ever feel like guilt and pressure, or did you when you're growing up? I know there's this passage where you make a lamb that is your grandmother turns up her nose at because it seems to have traces of your father's influence in it. And but do you feel that you know, that sense of like guilt, I guess, or loyalty towards one or the other coming up a lot in your everyday cooking?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm. I do. And it became clearer to me as I was writing, as you know, I progressed through Life Without a Recipe, I realized that both of those styles of cooking, and especially certain recipes and dishes, I really associate with either my grandmother or my father. And especially when I made my grandmother's, when I baked her pastries and dishes, I always thought about how she kind of used it as a weapon. You know, she was really trying to use these cookies and these pastries as a way to lure the children. I mean, very effectively, too. Dad, his cooking was more, this is what you do. This is our life at home. This is, you know, he was just unabashed. He was absolutely convinced the Mediterranean diet was the best diet. This was the freshest, healthiest food. This was the most delicious food. So it wasn't quite as loaded and as specific a weapon as my grandmother's baking was. And now as an adult. I do. Every time I made her Borscht cakes, her little German cookies, I always think about my dad.
It's like you're eating something that is going to offend somebody.
Right.
I mean, I think that's really interesting. It made me start thinking about, you know, how much of our sense of taste stem from this sense of loyalty to our elders, or perhaps lack thereof. I mean, you know, having grown up myself in a kitchen that was split between two worlds, I often have this little debate and sometimes try to. I sometimes try to mix the two cultures in cuisines.
Yes.
Do you do that ever?
Oh, so much, so much. Okay, I love that. Yeah, I actually think that that's a great answer to this kind of a conundrum, because, you know, we are products of both our worlds, or for some of us, many worlds. And so when you can play with the ingredients and preparations, you can make something your own. And I like a lot of those recipes. I have a recipe that borrows from my father. It's a roast chicken stuffed with za'atar stuffing.
Ooh.
And so, yeah, it's yummy, if I may say so myself. it's a classic American preparation, the roasted chicken with butter, but it also has this, classically Middle Eastern spice mix of za'atar and I love wedding those flavors together and just kind of feeling like, now this belongs to me. Mm-hmm. Or I recently made tahini chocolate chip cookies.
Ooh.
And very satisfying. You know, they were delicious, and it made me feel like a little victory. Like, okay, this is neither here nor there, but it's me.
Right.
I find myself in that in between place, and it's very consoling. It's very lovely.
So maybe instead of like life without a recipe, it's like making up your own recipes too as you go along.
Yeah.
Let's talk more about this book and your journey that you take through it. We need to cut to a quick little commercial interlude, but we'll be right back with chatting more with you.
Just your garden. It's the way you live. And there's so much to know. But you have help. Bonnie Plants. Now with Bonnie's app, Homegrown, you can learn about veggie and herb varieties, track and record your garden with photos and notes, share on Facebook and Twitter, and so much more. How'd you ever grow without it? Get Homegrown with Bonnie Plants for iPhone and Android. The more you know, the better you can grow. With Bonnie.
All right, we're back chatting more with Diana Abu-Jabbar. Thanks so much for joining us. Diana, you still there? Just checking.
I'm here, yep.
Great. So let's talk a little bit about what inspired you to start to write this memoir, because you've written four novels, including Crescent. You've also written The Language of Baklava, which was more explored your father's identity as an Arab-American. And, so this book really concerns more your identity as a wife and a mother. So just curious, what inspired you to go off on this new memoir?
New thing. It's funny because I don't think of myself as a writer of nonfiction. I write novels, and that's what most of my books are. But these memoirs seem to keep happening.
I was saying that last week I sort of kicked off a whole month of memoirs about food.
So, oh, so really?
You're starring in the month. So
interesting.
Yeah, it's pretty weird. You know, there's a whole crop of them. It's really exciting.
Yeah, I have found that I love reading culinary memoirs. Mm-hmm. I love the whole genre, and it's something I discovered, probably with M.F.K. Fisher, but then quickly Ruth Reichel and, several other writers that just really spoke to me, and I found myself drawn to the form. My editor actually originally suggested, after I wrote my second novel, Crescent, mm-hmm. It's a very much a food-oriented novel, and she said, you did all this work on researching these recipes and these dishes, why don't you go ahead and tell your family stories? And at the time, I thought there was no way, I didn't have enough material, but I started listing dishes and memories and food connections in the family, and I had to cut my manuscript in half because it was, wow. It was so long. So with Life Without a Recipe, I kind of got to a point where I felt like I had written my father's story, right. As a young man, I should say, his American story in the language of baklava, and I wanted to kind of own my own, mm-hmm. I felt like it was time for me to talk about my recipes, mm-hmm. and particularly my approach to trying to have a writing life, because that was something that was such a big struggle for me and a huge question when it came to thinking about whether or not to start a family. It was something I had been advised against. I'd had several writing advisors tell
me. Oh, really? Don't have a baby?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I'm so glad you did, Diana. I mean, I love this one scene that you describe. It's a hilarious scene, but you're speaking with a group of graduate students in women's studies, and they're like dissecting this short story of yours and looking for meaning and things like the male gaze and something like a phallocentric entity or whatever that means or something like that. And it's really funny because you're sitting there and you're mortified because you had recently written an erotica novel or something like that.
Yes, an adult novel.
An adult novel as a paying gig. And I guess as a successful female writer now, do you feel obliged to sort of further the dialogue in female identity in literature? Is that a concern that comes up often?
Well, I think about it a lot because I do feel like women we don't get the kind of support and the kind of attention that we should. Mm-hmm. That if you just look at the Vita statistics or statistics on what women are paid in terms of book contracts, we're still really under the radar in that respect, and even though there are so many brilliant women novelists and writers,
we still have to have
these movements. Mm-hmm. Getting encouraging women to claim their authority and each other. So I do. I feel very strongly. I am a feminist. I believe in equal rights for men and women. And I believe in equal rights for our stories. I can't count the number of times men have come to my readings, and when they ask me to sign a book, it's always for a woman. It's always for their sister or their mother or their daughter. Mm-hmm. They're embarrassed, to ask. Yeah. So it's frustrating, but I think it's a very important struggle.
Yeah. Well, I mean, okay, so this, you're this memoir, it is so fulfilling in so many ways for anyone just interested in food, for one thing, and, you know, growing up in different cultures and so forth. I think that, you know, in telling your life through food, it's also really a great way to explore the relationships that you've had, because you always eat. It's just like an everyday thing. And, you know, I love how you recall your first husband, you know, how you guys cooked through the Moosewood cookbook and, you know, all these little very specific details about the dishes that you would make. It recalls the context of that time and place and who you were then. So I think that, you know, writing about your decision to focus, you know, this memoir about yourself through food is a really great way to capture, I guess, all the relationships that you go through in life in a very succinct way and telling way. So I really enjoyed that.
I'm so glad to hear that, Kathy. I think it's a great filter for anyone who's interested in telling their life story. You know, think about a sensory detail, and it brings everything back in this kind of intensely heightened way. You get so much more, I think, when you start with the senses and then let the book go from there.
And that's such a universal thing, I think, men, women alike. You know, nowadays, what's interesting is that, you know, well, as you recall from your father's cooking, more men are cooking these days. I think that less and less women are, like, you know, the only ones
ironically
cooking, at least. So
yeah.
I don't know, you know, what exactly a male-written food memoir would look like, but so, you know, you mentioned a few writers that you like, food memoir writers, MFK Fisher. Is there any others that you would be, you know, you're inspired by?
Oh gosh, you know, there's so many amazing food writers, you know, I just read Jacques Pepin's food memoir. What a brilliant. And Monique Trong, she writes fiction, but with a strong food element. Kate Christensen, her food memoir, Blue Plate Special, is fantastic. Now it all goes out of my head. But, and of course, Ruth Reichel's Tender at the Bone. And then her subsequent memoirs, just beautiful. But I do think of MFK Fisher as kind of the quintessence of the form. She's just literary, sensitive, brilliant, and very, very sensuous.
Yeah. I think that there's so many writers nowadays who say they're inspired by MFK Fisher, and you really see that in the prose. Including yours. Oh. So that's really good to know that you're also a fan.
I'm honored.
Yeah. Actually,
Thank you.
On this show, we like to play a little game with our guests. And I know it's a surprise, so apologies for that. But it's a little bit of a quiz. And I'm going to take a quote. It happens to be from a food writer in this case. And I'm going to give you three guesses of who it's written by.
Ooh, okay.
So, the quote is, "It isn't only the expense, the monotony, and the false taste of the food inside most tins and jars and packages which turn me every day more against them. The amount of space they take up, the clutter they make, and the performance of opening the things also seem to me quite unnecessarily exasperating." Okay, there's another quote, but I'll just stick with that one. Okay, so was that written by A, Alice Waters, B, Madur Jaffrey, or C, Elizabeth David?
Oh, wow. give me the names again.
Alice Waters, who is the food, you know, local food pioneer from the 70s.
Yeah.
Or Madur Jaffrey?
No.
Brilliant.
No, it's not her.
Okay. Or Elizabeth David?
No.
British 50s food writer.
Yeah, yeah, it's definitely Elizabeth David. There's no way that's Alice Waters. That's Elizabeth David.
You're right. That would
really?
Be, yeah. You know, I was looking for something juicier she may have written, but I just thought that this, like, sort of, you know, everyday observations peppers everything with are kind of fun.
Oh, good.
Well, well done there.
Kind of cranky.
Yeah, exactly. A little bit cranky, a little bit just obtuse in some way or another, which is what we love to read from our forebears, I guess, in food writing.
Yeah. So. Yeah, yeah. No, it's good. It really shows you how different the sensibility comes through and how people like to live in their kitchens.
Mm-hmm. And it's a little bit ahead of its time, I think, with the disdain for the packaged foods. In the 50s, that was all the rage, I think. So,
yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah. Yeah, it reminds me actually a lot of my mother, because she loved those things.
Oh,
so, yeah.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed this little game of literary who wrote it.
Yeah.
I guess, unfortunately, that's about all the time we have for today, but I'm so glad that you could join us for a few to chat about this exciting new book. And where can we read about upcoming events? I know you're on Twitter as D. Abu Jabbar, and you have a website at DianaAbuJabbar.com.
Yes, just my name. Yep.
Excellent. Yep. So looking forward to your next memoirs or novels, whichever they may be as well.
Thank you, Kathy. Me too. Looking forward to getting back to the novel.
That sounds good. We'll look forward to that then. All right.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Diana. Thanks, everyone at Heritage. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Oh, I like the way you do.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.